From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. On this week's podcast, the customs agent at the airport may be looking for more than you realize.
What the judge found in this case is that the government does not even need reasonable suspicion to search or detain your electronic devices.
Plus, it might be the biggest internet mystery ever, a puzzle that the best codebreakers have been chasing around the world.
It's like a Dan Brown novel, if Dan Brown could write this well.
And how on earth did Russia spend $51 billion on the Winter Games? We'll explain on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. About a million travelers enter the United States every day. You might be familiar with the process. Regardless of citizenship, people who legally enter the U.S. face some sort of screening by Customs and Border Protection. But exactly what rights do people have at the borders? And when searching for drugs or contraband, is the government also allowed to look through the data on people's phones or laptops? Those questions have recently been tested in federal courts. And this past week, we got one judge's answer. The government can, without a warrant or reasonable suspicion, seize and search American travelers' electronic devices at U.S. borders. Susan Stellan is a contributor to the New York Times, and she's been writing about this case and others. She says, in general, different rules apply to searches at U.S. borders.
Despite the fact that there's a Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure, there's always been what's known as the border search exception to that, meaning the government has a right to look for contraband, which might be drugs, child pornography or the like, or inspect things to a degree that they wouldn't be able to do without a warrant if you were inside the U.S.
But we'd always, I think, thought about that being, like you're saying, drugs or contaminated farm issues, but not information you have in your devices.
Well, and that's an area where, the courts are kind of slowly catching up to technology. For a long time, people didn't necessarily, have all this information on devices when they left the country. And, court cases have kind of been working their way through the system, challenging whether or not border agents have the right to not only ask you to turn on and hand over your cell phone, a camera, for example, or your laptop, and potentially search and even detain that device for a period of time to do a more extensive search, which might involve, looking for keywords for different types of activity.
So let's break down what actually happened in the case that was decided this week. Can you explain who is Pascal Abidor and what happened when he tried to cross the border in 2010?
He's a graduate student studying Islamic studies, and he was returning from Canada to New York on an Amtrak train. And when they checked his passport...
And U.S. passport, we should say. U.S. citizen, right?
He is a U.S. citizen. He also has a French passport. So he was detained and taken off the train and questioned for several hours, and his devices that he was carrying were searched. And his laptop was kept for 11 days. And when he got it back, there was evidence that, the government had looked at different files or opened different things on his computer. So he became a party to a lawsuit challenging whether or not the government has a right to search your devices. What the judge found in this case is that the government does not even need reasonable suspicion to search or detain your electronic devices, that was a standard that doesn't apply at the border.
You know, it was interesting, the judge that ruled against Abidor wrote that these searches are actually very infrequent. So how often do these kind of searches take place?
Well, according to the statistics I've been given by Customs and Border Protection, the device searches happen about 15 times a day. What's harder to confirm is whether or not this is an accurate count. And there had been a document that came out as a result of a FOIA request by the ACLU that indicated that the CBP wasn't maintaining a good system of counting or cataloging these device searches. So we don't really know if these are accurate statistics or what they're counting.
We've traditionally thought of border and customs patrol agents, they're keeping things out, like drugs, contraband, child pornography, those sort of things, and not so much engage in this sort of level of national security, one might say, information acquisition.
Well, and that's really the question is, particularly for the more cursory cell phone searches, when the cell phone's taken out of your sight, what is happening? You know, is the data being copied? Is it being mixed with other data? You know, anybody who travels to the U.S., there is a file on you as a traveler that includes a lot of information about where you've been, when you've left the country, when you've entered the country, and that mixes with other information the government has in kind of a pretty broad network of databases that most people don't know exists. And, you know, I've even interviewed people who, you know, someone who returned to the U.S. forgot she had an apple in her bag, was traveling with small children from abroad. When she went to apply for one of the trusted traveler programs, she was asked about this apple incident, and she had forgotten it even happened. It had been so inconsequential to her, but yet that had made its way into her file. When you start mixing that with information that you might be carrying on a laptop or a cell phone or a tablet, what happens behind the scenes is kind of still an open question.
That's Susan Stellan. She's a contributor to the New York Times. She joined us from our New York bureau. Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
Who's the best team in college football? That's a good way to start a fight. The Bowl Championship Series, established in 1998, was intended to, if not settle the debate, at least civilize it. The BCS used a complex formula involving computer tracking and human polls to determine the teams that play in the five bowl games, and the BCS has been controversial since day one. But change has come to the NCAA. Monday's national championship between Florida State and Auburn University will mark the end of the BCS, making way for a new playoff system next year. Dennis Dodd from CBS Sports says the much-maligned BCS started off with the right intentions.
At the time, it's what the public demanded. They wanted to see a 1-2 game. The bowls over the years had been a mishmash of backroom deals, regional games that didn't pit the best teams at the end of the season against each other. And what the public failed to realize, and I think the stakeholders all along knew, that it was an evolution. It got us closer maybe to a true national championship, but it had its bumps along the way.
So it was supposed to, you know, if not eliminate debates, mm-hmm. at least reduce some of the rancor in terms of the championships and the rankings. But almost right away, people were complaining. What went wrong?
Well, unintended consequences. In 2001, Nebraska got to the championship game without so much as winning its division in the Big 12. In 2003, Oklahoma lost its conference championship game by 4 touchdowns and remained number one in the BCS and played for a national championship. You know, there were others. There were other, quote-unquote, injustices. So I think all that helped chip away at the credibility of it. And eventually, when things did change, the commissioners who run this, it was the public outcry that did it. It was a very grassroots, foundational thing that got the change going.
Can you explain the new plan?
It's a lot easier. We're going to have, going forward in 2014, a four-team playoff, 2 semifinals, a championship game. It will be arranged, literally, by a human committee, very subjective, and the committee will decide which team goes in every year.
So, you know, fans will always find some reason for discontent, but I have to say, though, from a fan's perspective, a casual perspective, it seems like there's already a lot to be suspicious of, starting off with this committee, these 13 individuals. It feels, you know, like a secret star chamber or something.
It's hard to criticize them right now. It's very credible. When Condoleezza Rice is on the committee, that's a pretty good committee. And there were immediate outcries about her experience in football. Well, actually, she's got quite a bit. I mean, she oversaw the football team when she was a provost at Stanford. She's a big fan, obviously. Tom Osborne, Archie Manning, the patriarch of the Manning family, who's head of the National Football Foundation. Steve Weberg, who for 30 years covered college sports at USA Today, is the media member on there. So it's very diverse. It's very credible, but you're right. They're going to have some hard decisions.
Dennis Dodd is senior college football columnist for CBSSports.com. Dennis, thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Russia is spending $51 billion on the Sochi Winter Olympics, the most expensive Olympic Games ever, by a wide margin. The preparations have not gone smoothly. Construction has been delayed repeatedly and marred by accusations of political corruption. The outlandish price tag for the Games has turned into an embarrassment for Russian officials. Joshua Yaffa's latest article on Sochi is the cover story for the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. Yaffa says that Vladimir Putin sees these Olympics as an important part of his legacy.
With the project having that sort of significance and that being obvious to all players involved, especially those involved in building the venues required to host the Olympics, nobody was shy about asking for more money. And everybody understood that with the projects so important to the top leadership of the country, there would be a sense permeating all the way down to the lowest levels that cost really was no object.
Now, expensive construction delays seem like they're par for the course with Olympic Games. Have the problems with Sochi been much worse than typical?
There's never been an Olympics that came in on budget, and I think that that's important to remember in looking at the story of how Sochi was built, in that it really magnified or exaggerated certain historical trends that have really been going back decades.
What have been some of the biggest boondoggles in the construction process?
Certainly the highest profile boondoggle, as you say, was the construction of the ski jump. It came in more than 2 years beyond its initial deadline. Costs rose to $265 million. And the official responsible for the construction of the ski jump had been fired from his posts. Criminal investigations were launched into alleged cases of fraud and embezzlement. He fled the country. And for many, the history of the ski jump became a metaphor for many of the issues that have seen throughout the various venues and infrastructure projects.
Do you think Sochi will be ready for the Games next month?
I think it will pull off the Games in a way that looks good on television. I've always been interested in at what cost has Russia put on these Olympic Games, at what cost to the Russian budget, to the Russian taxpayer, what that says about Russia's own policies and priorities under Putin.
Joshua Yaffa's story, Vladimir Putin's ego-driven, waste-filled, corrupt-riddled, security-challenged $51 billion Olympic adventure is the cover story for the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. Josh, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Walk into just about any coffee shop in California, and you'll probably see a sign warning you that you could get cancer from chemicals in the store's products. At the top, the signs say, Proposition 65 Warning. You'll find similar signs in any number of places. Parking garages, restaurants, apartment buildings. We went into a coffee shop in Los Angeles to ask people what they make of the signs.
I think I've just become so accustomed to them that I just don't really pay attention to them. I guess if I get cancer, I'll get cancer.
I have not seen any signs for Prop 65. I feel oblivious.
When we first looked at our apartment that we now live in, we saw a bunch of signs plastered all over and definitely scared us a little bit. But did it deter me from moving into the apartment? No. And does it deter me from going into buildings where I see it on the outside? No. It's just one of those things you see on the wall.
That was Steve Hankins, Amnita Chatha, and Alana Sarfati. The warnings are there to comply with a 1986 California law that requires companies to disclose if their products or facilities use chemicals that could potentially cause cancer or reproductive illness. And if a company fails to warn consumers, well, they can be sued. David Rowe was one of the original architects of the law.
The places where you see Prop 65 warnings tend to be things like gas stations, hotel lobbies where smoking is permitted, hotel rooms where smoking is permitted, things like that. It is important to be warned about it. It doesn't mean don't drink coffee. It means, is this a risk that you want to take among life's many other risks?
Rowe says when it was drafted in the early 80s, the intention of the law was to fix what many saw as a loophole in federal environmental regulations. The EPA only regulates chemicals when it knows exactly how much of a toxic chemical is too much. Finding that out requires an in-depth study, and that requires funding.
In other words, if you could slow government down, then you could keep these laws from actually having an effect, even though they were on the books.
Rowe says the California law has been a huge success. Consumers in the state are safer today than they have ever been.
Thousands of products have had toxic chemicals taken out of them, but you don't hear about it because most of Proposition 65's effect is companies deciding, I would rather switch than fess up about exposing people to toxic chemicals.
But in the quarter century since Prop 65 passed, a lot has changed. To start, the number of toxic chemicals it covers has ballooned from dozens to hundreds. Eric Bieber is a professor of law at UC Berkeley. He says no one realized how common carcinogens are. Today, the list of potentially toxic chemicals is so long that it's confusing to businesses who are trying to comply with the law. And that's only half the problem.
The law uses a citizen suit provision in which anyone can sue a company that allegedly is violating the law, and then you can get some money if you're successful in the lawsuit. The problem with that second solution was that it does create an incentive for more and more people to sue, and we've seen an increase in those lawsuits over the years, and arguably it's become a problem where you have lawyers targeting small businesses for some of these common everyday exposures like alcoholic beverages or cigarette smoke outside of a bar and using that to get some money but not actually producing useful information or useful reductions in toxic exposures.
Prop 65 suits have helped make California the most litigious state in the union. And as Bieber pointed out, those lawsuits disproportionately affect small businesses. John Kabatek is a spokesman for the National Federation for Independent Businesses.
Businesses, mostly small businesses, paid about $22.5 million in Prop 65 settlements in 2012 alone. That's up $11.8 million since 2007. And the real problem here is the largest proportion of these settlement funds have actually gone in the pockets of plaintiffs' attorneys.
By some estimates, more than half of Proposition 65 settlement money has gone to lawyers. For virtually all environmental law in the U.S., it's the government's responsibility to go after businesses or products that are hurting consumers. Think of clean water laws. It's the EPA or state regulators that say, hey, hold on, this factory is dumping toxic pollution into a river. That's dangerous. But Prop 65 doesn't work like that. The state just puts out a list of chemicals that might hurt you. The responsibility is on businesses to warn consumers and on consumers to sue if they don't. Eric Bieber says California has been like a lab, testing a new approach to protect consumers.
That's one of the things that was innovative about Prop 65 when it was enacted in the mid-1980s, was it flipped that burden of proof.
Is that approach better? Are Californians better protected?
I think you end up with companies being more risk-averse about toxic chemical exposure in products. That can also mean that it can be more costly, and that's one of the reasons you have this notice problem. Is what happens with a lot of small businesses is rather than try to fight this out in court, they just put the notice up. Even if they're not sure if there are any toxic chemicals in their product, in their property, it's just easier to put the notice up rather than fight things out in court.
In 2013, California passed an amendment to Proposition 65 that they hope will ease the burden on businesses. Small business owners faced with a lawsuit now have a 2-week grace period to post the appropriate warnings and have the suit thrown out. In the end, which approach is better, putting the burden of consumer protection on businesses or on the government, has to boil down to a matter of perspective or political philosophy. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. Walking up to the Boneyard, the Culver City Dog Park. We're investigating what might be the most fascinating science discovery of 2014. It's about dog poop.
Odd question. Your dog, I guess, is with you today?
Yeah, he's right here. Yeah.
Has he dropped anchor yet?
Yeah.
And did you notice which direction Bo was facing when he dropped anchor?
I didn't. I was on the other end of the park.
Have you noticed that Bo tends to be facing a particular axis when he's baking brownies?
Baking brownies, no. It's actually nothing that I've paid attention to, ironically enough.
You'll be relieved to know that someone is paying attention. A new study of pooping dogs found that they strongly prefer to do their business facing north or south. Sabina Begal is one of the researchers.
All people know dogs and know that they are pooping, and so we had a team of 37 dog owners, and they went out with, in total, 70 dogs. The dogs were not on the leash. They were in the open field, and the reporters noted the direction in which the dogs were facing when doing their number one or number two.
Dogs prefer to face north or south, but only when the Earth's magnetic field is stable, which it often is not. A lot of the time, the magnetic field is kind of wobbly and unstable, and when that happens, the dogs will drop their payload, well, any which way.
So we had this analogy. If you are on a hike, for example, and you look every now and then on a map, or you hold a compass, and if the compass needle is shaky or the map is not readable, then you might dismiss also reading the map.
Dogs aren't the only animals that sense magnetic fields. It's called magnetoreception, and migrating birds, hungry foxes, and fish and bees all use it. Begal and her colleagues added cattle to that list a few years ago.
After we published our first study on cattle in 2008, we got a lot of calls from people from all over the world, and they said, hey, I can also sense the magnetic field. And in the beginning, I was like, I can't believe it. But, you know, there were also at least one Nobel Prize winner among them. And then I said, so maybe there is something in this story that people can sense the magnetic field.
And what could humans accomplish with magnetoreception? That's still a mystery. And speaking of mysteries, we've got an amazing puzzle for you. No, wait, stop. Not that puzzle. Different show. Look, I don't want to offend, but this is a puzzle that's probably way too complicated for most of us.
It's like a Dan Brown novel, if Dan Brown could write this well, to be honest with you. I mean, it's beyond the realms of my intelligence and beyond the realms, I think, of any individual's intelligence to do this.
Freelance writer Chris Bell will guide us through this mystery. In a piece for The Telegraph, he wrote about an unknown organization posting incredibly complicated puzzles online to lure the world's most talented code breakers. It began 2 years ago with a simple message.
It arrived on an underground message board called 4chan, and the message was a simple black square with white writing on. And the message read, "Hello, we are looking for highly intelligent individuals. To find them, we have devised a test. There is a message hidden in this image. Find it, and it will lead you on the road to finding us. We look forward to meeting the few that will make it all the way through. Good luck, 3301. And that was all it said.
3301, the only signature left by the mysterious entity that launched the challenge. Thousands of people took it on. To code breakers who dwell in this world, it was simple in the beginning. The first puzzle used a technique called steganography, concealing a message or image within another image. Terrorists have used it to hide messages. Pedophiles use it to conceal child pornography. Hidden inside that first seemingly simple image, those black words on white text, were many more pictures, codes, clues, and one recurring image, a cicada.
That's why the puzzle was eventually named Cicada 3301, because it just appeared throughout. It's a bit like the moth imagery in Thomas Harris novels like Silence of the Lambs. So it began to symbolize the entire puzzle as it started.
If you decoded that first image, you were led to a website. That website contained more puzzles, even harder ones.
This is why thousands of people joined in, because no one person had the skills to solve all the puzzles.
Extremely obscure knowledge was needed to crack those codes. Knowledge of medieval Welsh literature, occult numerology.
There was clues based in cyberpunk literature. There was stuff from the Victorian occult. There was Caesar ciphers. There was Mayan numerology. Later on, it led to a telephone number. And when it reached a certain point, they solved clues that led to, 14 different GPS coordinates. In locations around the world, from places like Hawaii to Warsaw. And when the people visited these locations, they found this cicada image there again and a further clue.
This was one of the most complex puzzles the internet has ever seen.
And this is why people slowly started to realize that maybe it wasn't just some random, lonely kind of neckbeard sitting in his mum's basement. This was an international game. As the puzzles got more and more complex, people started to, suspect, is there a military organization behind this? Like, your NSA or people always seem to suspect the CIA are behind this kind of thing.
Some people, working in teams or individually, cracked the code and made it to the end. So, what happened?
Nobody knows. And this is part of the enduring kind of cicada mystery, is that after they got through all these tests the first time round, it led to a website on what's known as the dark net. And this is the part of the web that tends to hide various nefarious industries and things. It led to a website there, which once a certain number of people had accessed it, it closed down and left the message, we want the leaders, not the followers. And for thousands of people who are trying to solve the mystery, it was an enormous disappointment.
No one is quite sure what happened for the select few who made it.
There's lots of different rumours. None of them talked about it. They reckon there's between a dozen and two dozen people who made it to the final website. Apparently, they had to build a computer server and register certain addresses, but they never realised who was behind the tests to begin with. The path led and stopped.
But 1 year ago today, on January 5th, 2013, it all started over again. The puzzles with different techniques, new physical locations.
And again, once the first few people got through to that, the website closed down again.
And the mystery still continues. Chris Bell says it's become something special now.
It kind of tapped into all the things that the internet loves, in a way. It tapped into kind of slightly ludicrous conspiracy theory, and then the greatest thing, of course, is it never actually revealed its purpose. For thousands of people who set up websites to try and decode these puzzles, it's been a real, labour of love for many of them.
For the past 2 years, new puzzles appeared online on January 4th or 5th. And sure enough, this weekend, a ton of new puzzles appeared. Chris says the problem is, so far, all the ones he's checked out have been fakes. But he's going to keep looking. It's time now for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos. Happy New Year.
Arun, Happy New Year to you. Always good to be back.
So this week we're going to talk about some of the stuff you're excited about in the year ahead. One of those things, in a word, Japan.
Indeed. It's funny. Japan was a big topic here in the States in the 1980s as they kind of surged economically. They were very integrated into the American conversation. They receded amid some economic troubles, but they're back. Last year, Arun, while we celebrated a stock market recovery of some 30% here in the States, they were up by 50%. Not only that, you see them making major investments in clean tech and even getting a little more muscular, which may or may not be a good thing militarily. But all of that has put Japan back front and center.
And in a dramatic contrast to here, it seems like in Japan, they're kind of excited about their government or have a bit more confidence in the direction of their government.
Long story short, a number of governments in Japan over the last decade and a half have struggled to get the economy on track. And at long last, this prime minister, who in fact this is his second time around, seems to have gotten people pointed in a direction that they feel good about. And indeed, there's much more confidence, and it has shown up in no small part in their stock market.
Coming down to Hollywood now, just down the street from us, I love the way you put this. You say, we didn't know we were waiting for Denzel Washington's successor, but you say he's here.
He's here. So 41-year-old British actor Idris Elba, I know you probably enjoyed him on The Wire, in which he played a fabulous character named Stringer Bell. He also was good in the BBC detective series, Luther. But where he really seems to be breaking out is this new Mandela film. And now he's got two big upcoming films coming our way, one with Sean Penn called The Gunman and another called Beast of No Nation. So Idris Elba is not only one of People Magazine's hottest guys out there, but he's definitely an actor to watch.
And something else, I didn't know about these rumors floating around that he might be the next James Bond.
You know, they've only had five or six key people, and obviously Daniel Craig's in the seat now and has done a good job. Idris Elba is kind of the first serious name of a black actor that we've heard talked about in that regard. So what a big deal that would be.
I would love to see that. So finally, what's the company that you're keeping your eye on this year?
You know, it's funny. It's a company here in Silicon Valley, the car company Tesla. Of course, they're the makers of the first all-electric sports car. And for me, Arun, what Apple did in the computer industry, meaning kind of fundamentally redesign how average people think about computers, what HBO did in television in terms of blending both substance and style, it's clear in my mind that Tesla has tried to do that in the car space. They're the company that's a decade old. They just had their first profitable quarter last year, and they're looking to expand. In fact, their stock price last year, Arun, was up over 300%.
Wow. You mentioned Apple, and sort of like Apple in the early years, Tesla's had some ups and downs. You know, towards the end of last year, there was that issue with the around the battery fires. But sounds like they're on their way back up again.
Indeed, they seem to be. And as you said, there was the battery fire issue, and I'm sure there will be other parts of the conversation. But they really, you know, are injecting a certain sense of optimism back in the space. You might think of a sports car company like Tesla as being something for the big cities. The next place where they're looking to make a big dent is in the Midwest. Hmm. So lots to look at when you talk about Tesla.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, great to be with you.
We'll take a look back now at a best-selling book from the 70s, one you might not remember. The Spoils of Babylon by Eric Jonrosh, the epic tale of the powerful yet scandalous Morehouse family. It was made into a television miniseries that never saw the light of day until now.
My name is Devin Morehouse. Yes, that Devin Morehouse. But I didn't start out with that name.
Actually, everything about The Spoils of Babylon, even the writer, is fake. It's a parody of the big, bloated miniseries of a few decades back, like The Thornbirds or The Winds of War. The series begins this Thursday on IFC, and it stars Tobey Maguire and Kristen Wiig. Will Ferrell appears as the author, Eric Jonrosh, and as the Shah of Iran. The director of Spoils of Babylon is Matt Piedmont. He was a writer on Saturday Night Live, and he's worked with Will Ferrell's Funny or Die production team to bring this tale to the small screen. I asked Piedmont for the Hollywood pitch version of the story, which begins in the late 1930s. Actor Tim Robbins plays the family's patriarch.
Jonas Morehouse. Jonas has gone to Texas from New York to strike out as an oil wildcatter.
You see these hands? This nation was built by hands like these, honest hands, mostly African and Chinese, laboring under the belief that hard work is a religion unto itself.
Along the way, they pick up Devin Morehouse, becomes a Morehouse. They adopt him.
Literally pick him up by the side of the
they
road.
They do, pick him up by the road. This is 1938 now.
Well, you can decide on what you want to call yourself in due time. Hezekiah, Ezekiel, Steve, Jim Bob, Skippy, Jesus, Jerry, Vladimir, Hortensio, Maharishi, Billy.
They end up actually striking oil and becoming rich, very wealthy family. Devin Morehouse, played by Tobey Maguire, and Cynthia Morehouse, played by Kristen Wiig, fall in love, but it's a forbidden love as they're, you know, technically now brother and sister, although not by blood.
I do.
Devin goes off to war, comes back with a new bride. I won't spoil who the new bride is, voiced by Carey Mulligan, though, very talented actress.
The fact that she has to be voiced gives a little bit of
Yeah, no, I know exactly, but I'll just leave it at that. And then Devin goes his own way, becomes kind of a beat poet, kind of goes the green way, and Cynthia ends up taking over the company and becomes a little bit more like a traditional president of an oil company. They're trying to avoid their love for each other, which is very difficult. I know it's kind of a vague. I'm not very good about dishing the plot, but it's that's essentially the gist of it.
And sort of like The Winds of War or North-South, yes. The family history intertwined with the telling of America.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. See, why didn't I just have you do it in the first place? You should have, yeah, great, exactly.
And the lead characters age pretty well over the course of
They use a lot of special creams and things, so their skin stays very nice and moist. But yeah, no, they age over about a 50-year period. So.
Well, you do a lot of playing with time, because not only the work itself spans decades and decades, but the film, the fake film, which we're now seeing here for the first time, was made in 1979.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird meta stuff going on where Will Ferrell is a non-existent author of a non-existent bestseller who introduces this. And then the film was essentially a miniseries that was shot for 3 years from between 1976 and 1979, when never released. It's kind of like Amberson's, when Orson Welles made Magnificent Ambersons, and they cut that out, and then they released it. So this was never released, supposedly, and then they now are just, he needs the money, so they're doing a truncated version now.
Well, you mentioned Orson Welles, and there's a really Orson Wellesy kind of feel to the character, the author character, Eric Jonrosh, played by Will Ferrell.
Please, won't you enjoy part two of my wonderful miniseries, The Spoils of Babylon?
You know, it made us laugh, the 70s kind of Orson Welles, who, had kind of fallen from grace.
Did a lot of commercials.
Palmasan Winery commercials. Yeah. You've seen some of those where maybe he's a little intoxicated actually on air.
Why would I say wonderful? No one says wonderful. Sounds like something a man from a circus would say.
And the bitterness kind of comes through.
Yeah, I think what we liked is that he's bitter. If you see Orson Welles in the 70s, he still likes to hear himself talk. He may be bitter. That may come through pretty obviously. But you can tell once he starts getting warmed up, he likes the tales he's spinning. And so we kind of wanted to combine that in the character that we created for Will and have him to have some fun. Will, you know, there's no one better than Will Ferrell that doing those kind of stuff. So I think we came up with something that he had a lot of fun doing.
After a painful ordeal to bring my popular novels to television, I gave up. I could see that the network executives cared little for art, so I filmed The Spoils of Babylon on my own. I lived and breathed Spoils for 3 years. I slept with the cast. Every member of the cast you'll see tonight, I slept with. My wife at the time...
You have this reputation going back to your days as a Saturday Night Live writer for writing stuff that's just brilliant, but just so out there that it couldn't. Do you have more latitude with Funny or Die when you're pitching stuff like this directly to Will Ferrell?
Now, the problem is I think this is all normal. So maybe that says more about me when people say it's out there. To me, I'm pitching a normal idea. You know, I never really think of boundaries or thinking of is this too much or, you know, it's almost like if it's too much, let's go even further. And it seems to have worked out okay so far. But
Matt Piedmont is the writer, director behind the fake Spoils of Babylon, which will be premiering first episode this Thursday, January 9th on IFC. Matt, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Misty visions cloud my mind. All I've had, I've left behind. Like a stranger, I walk alone.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. During World War II, a group of women took a bold step in aviation. While male pilots were sent overseas, the women Air Force service pilots took up the war effort on the home front. From 1943 to 1944, they logged over 60 million miles across the U.S., flying 77 types of military aircraft to haul supplies and conduct training exercises. This week, the women pilots were honored at the Rose Parade in Pasadena, California. NPR's Daniel Hajek caught up with some veteran members before the parade.
Van Nuys Airport, an hour north of L.A., a group of 10 elderly women dressed in blue uniforms walk onto an airstrip where they're greeted by a small crowd and four World War II-era AT-6 Texans, two-seater propeller planes that bring back some memories.
Pratt Whitney engine, 650 horsepower, and it's a beautiful airplane. It will just do whatever you ask it to when you use the controls correctly.
That's 89-year-old Flora Bell Reese from Lancaster, California. She flew these planes 70 years ago when she volunteered for the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASP. She was inspired to fly as a kid in Oklahoma, watching the birds as she helped her dad farm.
In my life, my priorities are God first, family second, and then flying.
And her priorities were straight when she became one of 1,100 women who earned silver wings in the WASP, originally stationed in Sweetwater, Texas. The women pilots transported soldiers, test flew planes, and conducted training exercises as seen in this WASP training film, courtesy of Texas Women's University.
Nobody should ever tell a WASP that flying's not a woman's job. They wouldn't believe it any more than if it were said a girl can't be a good flyer and a woman.
One of their most dangerous missions, towing targets for anti-aircraft training, where guys on the ground would shoot live ammunition. Ask 94-year-old Elizabeth Strophus if she was ever scared.
Oh, no, not a bit. I loved every minute of it.
Today, these women get to play co-pilots as members of the Condor Squadron at Van Nuys, take four of them up in these old planes they've restored. On the ground, a line of active-duty female pilots salute as the planes pass in formation. Lieutenant Colonel Samantha Weeks says the WASP inspired her to become a pilot. She flies F-15 and F-16 fighter jets in the United States Air Force.
To have the opportunity to be around them and sit with them and listen to their stories and hear how they pave the road that allows me to walk the walk that I do in the Air Force today is just amazing.
Yet even today, the aviation culture is largely male-dominated. The FAA estimates that women make up just 7% of certified pilots in the U.S. These women are trailblazers. The AT-6s land and sputter back to the hangar. Elizabeth Strophus carefully climbs out of the cockpit. She's all smiles.
Good memories. It was a beautiful flight. I used to do a lot of formation flying. Of course, I always said I flew too close. I said, I thought that's what you're supposed to do.
Like the other wasps, flying is in her blood. When Strophis was 72, she hitched a ride in an F-16 fighter jet. Midway through her flight, she says the pilot gave her the controls.
So you took control?
Sure.
And what did you do?
Well, I didn't mean to make too steep a turn, but I got a 6G turn.
Six G's.
6 G's, yeah. And he said, hey, take it easy. I don't have the brown bag. I said, honey, you can have mine because I don't need it.
They've come a long way since the WASP was disbanded in 1944. These women were finally recognized as veterans in 1977, and they received the Congressional Gold Medal in 2010. Earlier this week, their own float at the Rose Parade. Members of the Women Air Force Service Pilots are like celebrities in the aviation world. They live for the thrill of flying. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
Finally, we have a late Christmas present for you, but it's a story worth waiting for. A woman whose father spoke to her nearly 70 years after he died in World War II. The story begins about a year ago in the library at the Baltimore Sun.
One day I was looking for something else and I noticed this black box, and it was like tied in rope.
Researcher Paul McArdle cleared away decades of old papers to free the box, and there he found vinyl record albums. The paper's multimedia editor, Steve Sullivan, wasn't sure if they'd found gold or just a dud.
But it was beautiful. I mean, it was a pristine copy of this 1943 radio show.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're about to bring you a full-hour special broadcast direct from England. This broadcast is a Christmas present from the Sun Papers of Baltimore, so that you may hear the voices of your servicemen and women overseas.
The show was like an audio time capsule left on a shelf and forgotten decades ago.
Just to show you that we're in the Christmas mood, let's have the whole gang kick off with Jingle Bells.
McArdle and Sullivan had to get this back on the radio. They contacted Baltimore Sun columnist Dan Rodericks, who also hosts a show on NPR member station, WYPR.
Knowing what it takes to pull off a remote broadcast even today, I'm very impressed at the quality of this. We aired it on December 20th and again on December 24th.
Underway with our program this afternoon.
This was just a bunch of guys from Baltimore or different places in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia, just speaking in their own voices, a little bit scripted, but all accurate and based on interviews with them.
I used to be a brakeman on the B&O.
And if you were back in the States today,
I'd be right back there in West Virginia. We'd be having turkey for dinner, probably a wild turkey that either Dad or I shot with the old squirrel rifle.
I mean, it's kind of charming, and it's also a little bit chilling to think about. These men are 6 or 7 months away from the invasion of Europe, and many of them in the broadcast have been through several bombing missions over Germany. So these men have been through a lot, and some of them were about to go through a great deal.
Including one man whose name jumped off the broadcast for a woman named Margaret Ann Harris.
I believe we have another gunner here, Sergeant Cody Wolfe of Catonsville, Maryland.
Cody Wolfe was her father, a father she never got to meet, and a voice she had never heard in her adult life. One of Margaret Ann Harris's friends heard the show live on WYPR and told her to go to a website where it was archived.
And it still didn't register in my mind that I was going to hear my father's voice until I heard it online for the first time.
What kind of a Christmas have you been having, Sergeant Wolf?
Not too bad, but I've been thinking a lot about Catonsville.
You have a family there?
My parents, my wife, my 16-month-old daughter, Margaret Ann.
It was so wonderful, and it was not a sad thing at all. It was just a wonderful experience to know that I could hear that voice and that my father said my name. That was the most poignant part.
And now you're an aerial gunner.
I'm a top turret gunner, one of the new crews like Sergeant Lane here.
No one expected my father to be on that broadcast at all. He had just arrived in England a few weeks prior. That broadcast was Christmas Day, and he was killed in action January 11th.
How did he sound? Did you have a concept in your head of what your father sounded like?
Never. I never had thought of it. And when I heard his voice, it was very typical of his family. It was very of the time, very calm and very reassuring voice, kind of like the Jimmy Stewart, Gary Cooper era.
Hmm.
And it was a safe voice, I guess because I'm his daughter. Hmm. It felt a voice that would protect you.
Obviously, you've lived almost your entire life without your father. He passed away when you weren't even a year and a half old. What is it like now at this point in your life to have this connection with him?
To hear him say my name and to know that I was treasured by him is just an awakening. It's something I always knew, but to hear the voice so wonderful, now I can hear him say other things. And my grandchildren heard the voice, and my daughters, and they all heard my father speak, which was a terrific Christmas present for our whole family.
That was Margaret Ann Harris of Catonsville, Maryland. She heard the father she lost in World War II for the first time this past Christmas season. If you'd like to hear that 1943 broadcast, you can find a link at our website, npr.org. And that's it for the podcast edition of All Things Considered for the week ending January 5th, 2013. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Chris Keneally, and Daniel Hajek. The technical director is Patrick Murray. We had engineering support from Leo Del Aguila and Theo Mondel. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories featured on All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.